This week on the Backtable Podcast.
As we talk about oh shit moments in the OBL, you know, one of the biggest things is vascular intervention is not free from complications. And there's embolization and thrombosis, and you have the ability to deal with some of these things with some forms of thrombectomy. So you have the ability to deal with some of these issues with thrombectomy devices, which, you know, you should have in your OBL, but sometimes a patient needs to be lysed. You know, you need thrombolysis and they need to be watched overnight. And having the ability to manage that patient with myself and my partners, rather than sending them to a hospital, having someone else manage that complication, have that patient become theirs. They reach out to the referring doc and say, hey, this patient came in from Watts' OBL. They had a cold leg with thromboembolic, you know, disease to the foot, and the arch was all socked in with clot, and I was able to rescue him, and you shouldn't send patients there anymore. That's a huge detractor to not having hospital privileges. As I mentioned before, some of the financial stuff where you can just screw the hospital with a huge bill where, you know, right, you wouldn't otherwise do that if you're paying out of your pocket.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Backtable Podcast, your source for all things interventional and endovascular. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and on backtable.com. First, a brief message from our sponsor.
BD provides clinical education and training through the BD Peripheral Intervention Advanced Healthcare Providers courses. The BD Advanced team offers programs on advanced endovascular management of AV access, emerging techniques in the management of CLTI and venous disease, as well as many different resident programs and peer-to-peer opportunities. Contact your local BD representatives to learn more or visit the BD Advanced webpage.
RadPad was developed by physicians for physicians. Clinically proven radiation protection during CINE and digital subtraction angiography. Don't bet your career or your health on anything less. Trust RadPad radiation protection shields for all your fluoro-guided interventions. See radpad.com for more information and contact info@radpad.com for a free radiation evaluation and a no-brainer radiation protection cap. And don't forget to tell them that you heard about it on the Backtable Podcast. Now, back to the episode.
Today, I got another great episode lined up discussing challenging cases or oh shit moments in the OBL setting. Hoping the audience can learn from some of these experiences. Today, we've got Backtable friends that have been on the show a number of times, maybe double digits between the two of y'all. Omar Saleh and Mike Watts, welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. So for those who maybe have not listened to any of y'all's prior episodes, just quick introduction of yourself and where your practice looks like. I'm going to start with you, Omar.
All right. So yeah, I'm an independent interventional radiologist, and I have a combined practice where I spend about, now I'm spending about 50% of the time in the OBL, ASC, and clinic, and where I do like just vein ablations and things like that. And then maybe the rest of the 50% doing a mixed IR diagnostic practice in the hospital. So my practice is always kind of constantly changing. Before I was doing more OBL, now I'm doing maybe more 50-50 or, you know, in the hospital. So it's kind of nice to have that balance for me, at least.
Great. Watts?
Yeah, I've had a little bit of a, I guess, of a journey. So I was at Penn for my first 5 years of my career, you know, just academics, you know, IR, doing some peripheral stuff at the Philadelphia VA. And then I left there and spent 3 or 4 years in just like hardcore outpatient OBL peripheral arterial disease, critical limb ischemia with no hospital kind of overlap. And I've kind of regressed a little bit towards the mean now in my current practice, where I'm a partner in a big private radiology group where we have our own vascular institute in New Jersey. And we have 9 IRs and 6 vascular surgeons. And we cover a number of hospitals as well as 3 outpatient labs. So my personal practice, on any given week, I'll generally spend 1 day in the hospital, 3 days doing cases in the lab, and then usually 1 day, full day clinic. But a lot of critical limb ischemia, and you know, that's really what I spend my time on. I have a lot of partners who do more of the embo stuff and a few other things, veins. But that's pretty much what I do, you know, a little bit of hospital, but mostly OBL.
Great. Thanks, guys, for the intros. Omar was most recently on the show talking about the KELT device, where closure devices in general, but specifically we're talking about the KELT device and actually how great it works for the OBL setting. So anybody who didn't catch that, go back and listen to that one. probably going to be relevant to some of the stuff we're talking about today. And Watts has been on the show previously to talk about the OBL setting, you know, the pros and cons for the most part. Thanks, guys, again for coming back. I'm going to start with Omar because he was the one that had the idea for this episode shortly after the closure device episode, because him and I were texting back and forth about cases where a good closure device is super helpful, you know, especially when you have a case that doesn't go that well. It's especially challenging. And Omar was sharing that with me. And so, Omar, I'm going to start with you. I know you've had some times where, you know, whether it be a device malfunction or something unexpected happens and you're stuck trying to figure out what your next move is. Can you talk us through maybe even the case you were briefly telling me about and where and how you've used creative thinking to kind of get a better outcome?
Sure thing. Yeah. You know, in the OBL, I feel like our OBL has like pretty much anything you need to kind of get out of these problems where if you get some kind of complication or some kind of challenging case, how to solve your way and get out of it. Like half the battle is having the right tools to get out of it. Sometimes I feel like I'm in the hospital and I don't have the things I need, and you know, where we have to sometimes get it from my OBL. So it's kind of funny. When me and you were talking earlier about like a case that was like a crazy, like, oh shit moment. It was a patient that I was treating. She had severe PAD with rest pain and wounds and like a non-healing TMA site. So we were doing an angiogram on her, and she had severe femoral popliteal disease, tibial disease, and we were going to just try to treat the femoral popliteal disease. And we got through the lesion, and we placed, I decided to use a Hawk atherectomy device, Turbo Hawk atherectomy device, and we placed a spider filter wire in the popliteal artery. And then, you know, we're engaging the lesion with the Hawk device. And then I think I'm trying to still figure out what happened, but you know, it's a directional device. So I think the wire may have gotten wrapped around, and it was a monorail device. So you have to be really careful with how you turn it and turn it back the same direction. And then also the edge of like the tip of the device kind of got broken, where it didn't completely break off, but it was like disfigured enough where you can't resheath it. Okay. So you're stuck with this device. So we're trying to pull it out. We noticed that it's not working. We noticed it, and we're trying to resheath it, and it's stuck in this sheath. And we had a 6-French sheath up and over. So we're trying to pull it out, and it's like, it's not going into the sheath. And we're like, okay, how are we going to get out of this? Right. And it's a 6-French hole. So we're like, okay, so I guess the most important thing here is to put another wire in the sheath so you have some type of access, right? Because you're going to try to pull out this sheath and device and then try to fix it and get control. So anyways, we put a V18 wire into the sheath, and then we're pulling out the sheath and the device. And, you know, the device is not in the sheath, so it can cause the arteriotomy site to get bigger, right? And cause possible injury to the common femoral access that we had, right? So when we pull out the device, we have our V18 wire and we have the 014 filter wire coming out of the access site. The sheath is out, the device is out, but pulling out the device probably made that 6-French hole probably like a 9 or 10-French hole, you know, as you're trying to pull out this mangled device, right? So it's a pretty much oh shit moment. But I mean, what saved us is, you know, having that extra wire access, the V18 wire. So then through that hole, through the V18 wire, we put in the 6-French slender sheath. And that's important, right? You got to have these sheaths also where there's no transition, like, you know, smooth transition where you could put through a 014 or 018 wire. If you just had a regular sheath, it wouldn't have worked. So we put in a 6-French slender sheath into the 018 wire, and then we put in a 5-French slender sheath into the 014 filter wire. Then we were able to retrieve the 014 filter wire, and then we were able to upsize the 18 wire with like a stiff glide 035 wire. And then we were able to take out the 6-French slender sheath and put in a 7-French sheath. And then held with the pressure, able to get hemostasis, and then we finished the case, and then we closed it with a 7-French kelt. So, and in that case, I think a 7-French kelt helped us because the arteries were so calcified. I don't think any other type of closure device would have worked, like, and it's such a big hole. So I think we probably closed that 9 or 10-French hole with a 7-French kelt and after, you know, finishing the case. But that's one of those times where you're like, well, how do you fix that? I mean, I guess if you don't have any option, you're holding pressure, but that patient probably would have had to be transferred or something to the hospital, or maybe you're holding pressure for like an hour or two, who knows. But that was the case that I wanted to share with you guys in case you have and it's not necessarily Hawk. It could be, you know, some other device, a Rotarex or any device that breaks, or, you know, you can't get out, you know, you can't, or something's stuck and you have to cause a little bit of trauma pulling it out. So that's a little trick I wanted to share with you guys.
Yeah, everybody's going to have their complete cluster cases, but it's great to think how you can just basically make sure that whatever your next step is, the patient's safe, right? So if you make sure, there's some things you're going to have to do rapidly, and you're going to have to, you know, hold pressure, and you're going to have awkwards, like, all right, I'm going to hold pressure here. You're going to take this, you know, balloon off, put the sheath on, you know, whatever it is. And those happen rapidly. But otherwise, patient stable, patient safe, you can think about it. There are two things that I loved about your story. One is that you said, there are things at the hospital I don't have and we have to get from my OBL. We're the exact same way. And so everyone's like, well, you know, I'd feel more comfortable. It's usually referring doctors, right? Hey, I just saw Miss Smith. She's, you know, got an ABI 0.2. She's got rest pain. She's got, you know, multi-level disease. I'm going to treat her next week in my office. I think it's going to go really well, whatever. They're like, well, I'd really prefer if you'd done it in the hospital. And they have no idea. They think there's a safety concern where a lot of times, because the hospital techs aren't as well trained, the hospital nurses don't know what to look for. In recovery, that's the biggest problem. You know, if that patient that you sent to recovery, if your team understands what went on in there and understands what to look for, they're going to be a lot more likely to tell you that something is going wrong rather than just pack you, where nurses check in, you know, every half hour and not kind of blowing off some of the concerns that you would have. The other thing, and I really kind of want to make this point too, is you use a Hawk and you use a spider wire, right? So we're in the OBL and there's this really difficult to deal with perception that we do everything to pinch every penny and make as much money as possible. And a filter wire, whether it's a spider wire for a Hawk or a NAV6 for, you know, for a Jetstream or for a Rotarex or whatever, is $1,000 that's not reimbursable. And so people say, well, you can't do that in the OBL. You'll never survive, you know, financially. And that's not true. I know Omar and I both use like Serenator balloons. You know, these are balloons that cost upwards of $1,000 and they're not reimbursed. Right. But it's the best thing for the patient to use these devices, because you're going to make these patients better and you're going to improve your business with your referrals and the patients. You know, it's just, you need to do these things as a practice. And what I learned coming from a completely OBL practice to an OBL kind of hybrid hospital practice is there are definitely some things where the cost, if you're going to use a number of I-bonds or something, DBXs, you know, things that are going to cost in the thousands of dollars, you can take those patients to the hospital and do the right thing for them rather than doing the wrong thing for less money in an OBL. So you just have to be free to practice the appropriate way to treat your patients kind of finance free. So I think those are really important parts of the case that aren't about the complication and aren't about the rescue. That access point is always the biggest issue. And you've tried to plan before every access, I always plan how I'm going to get out, always. And that I think is the OBL mantra for me. Figure out how you're going to close before you start. And that's great in 99% of the time, but when you have something where you're, you know, you have a device malfunction, I've had an up and over sheath tear and come out, you know, half of it out, half of it still in, right? And so then, you know, then what, right? So then it's contralateral access. And, you know, you have to put in a 10-French sheath so you can snare what's left of your 6-French sheath and pull it through. Again, same thing Omar did. You put wire through, you take everything out, you have some wire, and then you can, you know, try to get whatever else you can back in. And then as you're holding pressure and you're still leaking around that 10-French sheath, you're like, okay, now what do I do? So this was years ago for me, and I had a similar thing where I know I have a 10-11-French hole in this artery, and I didn't have anywhere to transfer them to, you know, that you could, I guess, come back up and over and stent graft that whole common femoral artery, which is really not the right thing for the patient, but in a life-saving situation, you can do it. But I had a 8-French angioseal. So like, okay, well, I think that'll work. It's off-label, but I know it's a big plug and I think it'll work. And, you know, it did the job. But again, it's watching the patient afterwards. It's having your staff understand what to look for and what you're, you know, what you are concerned about. And then if it's, you know, holding extra pressure, or if it's just, you know, even holding pressure after the closure device with ultrasound guided compression. So you're watching, you know, making sure you're holding it in the right place. You know, these are things that, you know, you don't have that margin of error in the outpatient lab. And so if you can avoid the complication, great, but you need to know multiple ways to make sure it doesn't become disastrous.
What tore the sheath, Mike?
So this was a lady who was like in her 90s and very, very badly calcified. Some of the worst calcification that I've seen. So using, you know, kind of a non-hydrophilic, I guess, or only partially hydrophilic sheath as you're going up, you know, for the first kind of turn and then the second turn and then a sharp bifurcation and then, you know, through another turn, you get friction points at every one of those calcified bends. And those friction points continue to add up and add up and add up. And if so that the goal is, right, you know, you put the dilator back in, you try to stretch out that or flatten that bifurcation a little bit. But when you have, you're really talking about maybe four or five really strong points of calcified friction, sometimes it's not coming. You're like, all right, let's make sure we have wire access and let's go. And, you know, it's scary because, you know, what ends up happening, if you've seen the inside of these sheets, they're just coiled wires, right? So you get a tear and you're standing there with a piece of whatever it is, the plastic PTFE, and then just a coil coming out, going into an open groin, you know, with a glide wire through it. You're like, this is not ideal, right? So it's like hold pressure as we get access to the side, snare up and above, try to oversheath with a bigger sheath. And it's just like everything, nothing ever goes right. So like, okay, well, this was a good plan, but now we need to alter it a little bit. You know, do I need to go back up through the other side inside that coil with a wire and get it through and snare that and then oversheath that? And can I cut this coil? And if I cut this coil at the entry site here, now I could pull it out this way with a wire up and over. As long as you've done this a lot, when I think Omar and I have both done this a lot, we did a back table podcast, the two of us, in like 2018 or something about OBL PAD stuff. So we've been doing this for a while. And you just, you know, as long as you're keeping the patient safe, you're thinking what the worst thing could happen and you're avoiding that, and you go step by step until you problem solve, like he did with his double sheath access and the big kelp.
Well, on that topic, actually, because I think at the time, maybe both of you were actually in just purely OBL settings back, you know, 2017 or 2018 when we did that one. And now, you're both in this sort of OBL hospital hybrid practice. Do you think, and Watts, I heard you give the cons of OBL talk at Western Angio. Do you think that that's the ideal sweet spot for an interventional radiologist to have this sort of hybrid model where you're not purely hospital, you're not purely OBL, you kind of have the best of both worlds?
Yeah. Thinking about the difference in my practice now, I wouldn't go back unless things change some way. And I'm not even sure how that way is. I think it really is ideal to have that possibility. And as we talk about oh shit moments in the OBL, you know, one of the biggest things is vascular intervention is not free from complications. And, you know, there's embolization and thrombosis, and you have the ability to deal with some of these things with some kind of, you know, some forms of thrombectomy. So you have the ability to deal with some of these issues with thrombectomy devices, which, you know, you should have in your OBL, but sometimes a patient needs to be lysed. You know, you need thrombolysis and they need to be watched overnight. And having the ability to manage that patient with myself and my partners, rather than sending them to a hospital, having someone else manage that complication, have that patient become theirs. They reach out to the referring doc and say, hey, this patient came in from Watts' OBL. They had a cold leg with thromboembolic, you know, disease to the foot, and the arch was all socked in with clot, and I was able to rescue him, and you shouldn't send patients there anymore. That's a huge detractor to not having hospital privileges. As I mentioned before, some of the financial stuff where you can just, you know, screw the hospital with a huge bill where, you know, right, you wouldn't otherwise do that if you're paying out of your pocket.
Yeah. Omar, same question for you. Do you think that that's more of a sweet spot? You said that, you know, your practice continuously evolves, but it seems like part of evolution is improvement. So you think it's better now than being purely one side or the other?
Yeah, definitely. Because like Watt said, you sometimes have these complicated cases that may require more expensive treatments like Biobonds, multiple Biobonds, where maybe you have an occluded, like a 5-year-old occluded FemPop bypass graft that you realign, you Rotarex realigned with Biobond and need filter and everything, you know, so it could turn into a big case. And that patient, even if they embolize like a little bit, they may need to be lysed in the ICU, right? So you don't even want to do anything like that in the OBL. You want to take that patient to your hospital and, you know, have like, your vascular surgeon backup, ICU backup, things like that. Working at the hospital has also helped me have better relationships with my referring doctors and other vascular specialists, like the vascular surgeons I work with. You know, we send each other cases, and it's actually growing our practice for both of us. And you know, the other, you know, so having that hospital relationship also is very important. Other thing is, you know, some insurances don't pay well here, at least in California. You can't, some of the stuff is not covered in the OBL, and you may have to have some kind of ASC or hospital to take it to. So that's an advantage to have those options to do it. Also, I had an instance where I had a complication where it was a simple thing where just the patient had like a pseudoaneurysm or something. She was transferred to the hospital. We had a transfer agreement with this hospital. And then the vascular surgeon there is like kind of my competition. And he was trying to badmouth our OBL. You know, it was like one of those type of things. After that, I mean, we're like, okay, we're just going to send it to our hospital or send it to our vascular surgeons. Cause you never know. And this could be for any specialty. If you're competing with other specialists or something like that, and you end up transferring to their hospital and things like that, it could turn into, you know, where they're trying to, you know, say something bad about your practice, and it's just not worth it. And also, I don't like the fact that, you know, if you do send a patient of yours to some hospital that you don't know the person taking care of that patient, they may not get the care that you wanted to give that patient, right? So it's kind of, you want to have that control where, you know, they may be like, oh, nothing more could be done. Let's just do an amputation, where, you know, you could have just done a little extra work and saved that, like, you know, patient from getting an amputation or worse, you know, outcome. So those are some of the things I've seen. So that kind of made me want to do more hospital work and have that kind of presence in the hospital to balance my, and I think that helps my OBL practice, helps my clinic practice, and it also helps my hospital practice.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. So I know that we've talked over the years privately, and, you know, you have fully OBL practices of different specialties, whatever, down the road from you. And I have fully OBL practices down the line from me. And if you have a patient who has a synthetic bypass graft that's, you know, occluded and full of clot, and as you say, you're going to reline it with Vibons after you filter atherectomy, thrombectomy, and then, you know, you could even put them on a heparin drip overnight to make sure everything's good, or you may lyse them if they need it. If that patient shows up to your fully OBL partner down the street, are they doing all that, or are they going to go in with whatever the cheapest atherectomy device of the day is? Maybe it's a rotablator for $700, buzz it so they can bill it and put a bare metal stent, like a smart stent that cost them $280 at the distal anastomosis, and call it a day.
Sorry, wait, are you talking about like my competition, or are you talking about
partners? So no, your competition, right? So we know because we have the option, there's not a fully OBL-based vascular practice, I think, that I've come across that's going to turn that patient down. And they're not going to say, hey, you know what? I can't do what's right for this patient, right? They're going to kind of slap together some sort of treatment that's going to open the bypass, but and may end up causing, you know, embolic complications, may end up, you know, making the kind of janky anastomosis worse with a fracturable bare metal stent across the knee, right? So I think that's part of kind of what we're both saying. You know, just like you outlined, you know, there are patients that are going to do much better long-term with hospital-based care. It's not a lot of them, but it's some of them. And, you know, I think that as my practice evolves and, you know, my partner and I are doing a lot of DBAs, you know, that's something that I can now offer people. Which, you know, there are OBL DBAs, and there's other products that are coming down the line that will make it less expensive and will make it, you know, easier to do in certain patients in certain cases. But for me to have say, all right, well, this patient is no longer a no option patient, I can take him to the hospital and do advanced therapies. Again, it just adds more to my practice. But anyway, we're talking about OBLs. So, you know, there are definitely pros and cons to having that hybrid practice.
Yeah.
Right.
Great use of the word janky there. I'm sure Josh appreciates that, Mike. So we've been talking a lot about arterial cases. You guys do a lot of PAD, CLI work with atherectomy. For those who maybe don't do those cases, in the OBL. Any other kind of OSHITs, you know, a UFI or a filter retrieval or something along those lines, anything come to mind? I'll start with you, Omar.
I'm trying to think. I do a lot of UFIs, and I haven't been very fortunate not to have any UFI-related complications, but, you know, watch something happen next week.
Dialysis always dicey.
Yeah, dialysis work. Okay. There was one case recently where I think I was trying to do a maturation for an ellipsis endo-AVF, right? So, you know, I don't know if you know the anatomy, but it's like a perforator vein hooking up to the cephalic vein and radial artery, right? I was like, oh, you know what? The flow is too much in the basilic. I'm going to do a percutaneous banding, okay? And I'm doing this like percutaneous banding, and I think, I don't know what happened, but my hemostat, which is like a blunt object, caused some kind of tear in the perforator vein. You know, when I'm just like, you know, creating it like percutaneously, it's just like such a simple, easy thing that turns into an oh shit moment, right? And all this, like, it's like bleeding from the percutaneous sites. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Did I damage like the brachial artery? Like, was this like crazy? So luckily, you know, we had our radial artery access. So we took some pictures of the brachial artery. The brachial artery was fine, but there was like a hole in the perforator vein. And it's like a fistula, right? So you're like, okay. So luckily, like I said, in our OBL, we have everything, right? So we put a 6x5 Biobond in the perforator vein and sealed it. And the patient's doing great, you know? We kind of gelled off like that little basilic area. So like now his fistula is mature. So he's doing great.
You say this is an everyday, you know, basic thing. You are the only person who's doing percutaneous banding of fistulas.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah,
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I know you've talked about cases of these for years, and we're always like, it's amazing when you do these things. But you know, it's because we're IRs and we know how to do these things, and so we have the tools to do these things, so we understand the physiology. So a couple of weeks ago, I was thinking about this podcast because we backed it off a couple times. I'm like, all right, well, whatever. This is what we'll talk about. We'll talk about access groin arterial complications. We'll talk about embolization and thrombosis, and we'll talk about like MIs or strokes and whatever. And those are our oh shits. All right. So hold pressure or ultrasound guided pressure or stent graft, and then, you know, transfer to hospital. So I'm like, okay, well, I don't have too much else to talk about. Maybe Omar will have interesting things. So I got this patient who came to me, older guy, big guy. He's got some chronic venous insufficiency changes, you know, skin changes in his left leg, but his right leg's massive. And it's got this ulcer that's been there for a while, and he gets referred to me from wound care. I'm like, this is a little bit odd. I can, you know what, Aaron, I can do a whole 90-minute back table just me on how much I hate iliac vein stents. I hate iliac vein stents. I will just preach. Anyway, but this guy had a CT done of his pelvis from a couple of years ago, and I looked at it, and right on his right side, right where the iliac artery bifurcates between the internal and the external, there was significant compression of his iliac vein. So I'm like, all right, you know, the only iliac stents I ever do are for occlusions. They're post-thrombotic, you know, they're patients with wounds. You know, I don't ever do non-thrombotics. So I'm like, all right, well, this will help the guy. So I bring him in. I get right groin access to go up through the narrowing on the right. I run IVUS. He's a big guy. His vein's about 18 millimeters above, 18 millimeters below, and it's about 10 and a half at the compression point. Like, all right, well, what do I have? I have an 18 millimeter by 80 millimeter Venovo. Well, I would like it to be a little bit bigger, but that compression point is so small, it's not a big deal. So I put it in, deploy it. Don't really see, you know, a waste or anything. I'm like, okay, let me balloon it. And as I'm getting the balloon in, I watch the stent go up to the confluence. So, you know, I'm thinking, because this is a dynamic compression, right? So this is the artery is beating and the compression is legit, but there's no, you know, kind of synechiae or scarring or actual physical compression to keep that stent there. So I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be an issue. So I have another 18 by 80. I go up and I try to overlap the bottom half and then have the bottom half of that second stent go in the compression point. So I get up there, I land it where I want it, get my balloon, and the guy coughs. So it goes up further. Now I have this which is basically now an 18 by 120 stent construct working its way up to confluence. So, okay, I find that I have a 20 millimeter wall stent. All right, let's go put my 20 by 120 wall stent up inside there. We'll just, you know, stretch it and pin it. So I put it in. I'm happy where it is. I stretch it. The wall stent shortens. So I'm no longer at the compression point, and now I'm watching this thing go up into the IVC. I have a wire through him. Now, this guy's big. I'm in the OBL. I have a great C-arm for peripheral arterial stuff, but now I'm in the belly. You don't see things very well. Yeah. You can't see contrast very well.
Yeah.
So I have a wire through it. So I'm like, okay, I know I'm in a time crunch here because this thing's, I now have this long stent construct that's freely mobile, and I don't have any bigger stents. And so I'm trying to think what to do. So first thing, I'm like, all right, let's get this wire up in the IJ, right? Because I don't want the stent to go at the end of my wire and then end up in the heart. So right. Now Omar knows this. We're in the OBL and we're here looking at the pelvis. I can't move him down on the table enough, and I can't move the C-arm up enough to see anywhere above the diaphragm, right? And so it's like, okay, well, now do we unlock the table, unlock the C-arm, pull the table out and move it around the base of the C-arm so it's around the table, and then come up and look high so I can get this wire here, and then I'm moving him around. He's breathing and coughing. So I send the wire up, and everybody in the room is kind of looking at me. I'm like, okay, well, I can either try to extend stents from the inside of this all the way down to his common femoral and try to pin it like that, but I don't think that's necessarily going to work. I could come across other side, stick the other side, and try to pin, like make a double kind of chimney thing. But I also don't know. This guy's got a huge, you know, huge cava. He's got huge veins. I can't see the cava, you know, because I'm injecting contrast. I'm putting IVUS up there. I see that there's space around everything, but I don't want to nudge things too much. So I'm in my OBL now, and I'm like, okay, this can't go to the heart. This is the worst possible thing that I could do. I'm sweating. I'm like, okay, I have IVC filters. So I grab a femoral Denali and I send it up there and I deploy it. It's super renal. It's sitting kind of like in that intrahepatic IVC, but now I know these things can't go anywhere.
Right.
I pull everything out, hold pressure. I get the guy and he wakes up like an hour later. I'm like, well, he's like, I feel so much better, doc. I think you fixed me. I was like, sir, let me tell you, sir, I didn't fix you. He's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I put stents in there, but you know, your veins are so big that, you know, and the way your compression is, they didn't stay there. So now they're working up through your belly, but I put a filter there to stop it. It's like, you don't need this filter there. We're going to have to get it out. He's like, I feel really good though. I'm like, look, we're going to have to, you know, basically, you know, give it a couple of weeks. I'm going to do a CT venogram. And then what I'll end up doing is like, I don't know, a 24 dry seal, you know, both ways, get a big, you know, and then I probably try to snare these, pull these down, pin them down, something. I'm still worried about how we're going to do it in the hospital, but I'll have better imaging. But right now he's safe, right? So that's it. It's like, what can I do? What else do I have? How can I make sure that the worst thing doesn't happen? I mean, the guy, he's so cool about it. He doesn't care. He's like, oh, well, you know, you tried to help. I'm like, I certainly did.
That's really smart.
It's not something I'd ever thought about. I don't want to take credit for, you know, being some kind of, you know, MacGyver genius in the IR suite. It's just like, you know, that your adrenaline kind of picks up, because if it's an arterial issue, I've come across it before. I've dealt with every arterial issue and I can deal with every arterial issue. This is not something that I like to do. And this is, you know, and I think about people who do these non-thrombotic iliac vein stents all the time. And I think about, you know, what can happen. And you know, you hear stories of, you know, cracked chests for removing stents. And, you know, we've lost stents off the market for similar reasons. But man, if I do five a year, now I'm doing one a year maybe. But
yeah, using what you got, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the filter, I thought you were going to say that you deploy the filter right in the middle of it to pin it where it was, but you actually put it above it to just protect so it wouldn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
That's really cool. But what about a balloon? Like, could you have inflated a balloon? Because you were just trying to get it back down, right?
Yeah, so these are 18 millimeter and 20 millimeter stents, right? So, I mean, I guess I have an 18, but I was using the 18, you know, I don't think it would have. And, you know, we've got this really long stent column. It's, you know, if I sit back and think about it now, I think there's other things I can do and other things I could try. But, you know, at that point when it's like literally you're watching this thing go.
Yeah.
It's a little higher.
Yeah.
So, there's definitely things that you run into. And even now, you know, I've been almost fully OBL since 2016, right? So this is my eighth year or ninth year, however you do the math, of dealing with outpatient stuff. And still you're running across stuff that, you know, you're not equipped to deal with. And it can be from an imaging perspective or a room setup perspective, or everybody makes, you know, kind of, I don't say dumb mistakes, you know, but everyone, you know, does something they wish they didn't do. And that's, you know, that was one of it. And it's like, all right, well, let's figure it out. So there's more than just arterial stuff.
Well, one thing that Amar and I were talking about, in addition to like the arterial stuff, is like things, and this is kind of what you were talking about, Watts, is just like what you think is bread and butter doesn't end up being bread and butter. And so I was briefly in the OBL space, you know, for a couple of years before COVID hit. And so I had shortly before COVID, I had a filter retrieval that I had actually placed a few months before. So it was like a typical Cook filter, and placement was pretty straightforward. Lady comes back off shoot. I think she was having some sort of surgery, comes back for the filter retrieval. And to go back to what we were talking about, like just be, you know, your OBL being equipped in your case is better than the hospital. In my case, it was not. We had retrospectively the bare minimum to do. The cases I was doing were more venous cases. And so anytime I had anything out of the ordinary, it was a sales rep bringing their trunk stock, right? And I didn't do much of that was out of the ordinary. And I love filter retrievals. It's my favorite, probably my favorite procedure. So I was excited to do this. And I thought, okay, you know, it'll be a simple stare. Hasn't been in that long. My filter, I want to retrieve it. And so I brought her in and, you know, we just had a simple GEOEC C-arm. And I get down there and I had the Cook filter retrieval set. Her filter over the course of the 3 months had tilted and was stuck up against the wall of the IVC. And so I was like, okay, I couldn't get the hook of the filter with the snare just by trying. I even tried that like clover thing to try and, you know, get it off the wall. It wasn't working. So I was like, all right, I'm going to do loop snare technique. You know, I had a sauce Omni flush I could use. So I got it. I got the wire back up, snared the wire, was trying to pull it off the wall. And it wasn't really coming off. So I was like, okay, I'm done. I'm going to call it here. I've tried as best as I can here in the OBL. I'll send her to the hospital to get this out. So I'm trying to disengage the loop snare, and the actual sauce catheter, which I usually have there to protect the wire from the filter, had come back. And so the wire was actually stuck on the filter. And I had already let go of my snare so I could get everything out, was stuck. And so I'm like, shit. So then, the tip of the wire was in this place where I couldn't re-snare it. It was like up against the wall. So now like my wire is always stuck on the filter inside her body. And I'm like trying to push it down to get it to disengage from the filter. And this was kind of my oh shit, because I was like, well, if this thing's stuck, what am I got to... This wire's sticking out of her neck now. Like, how am I going to wrap this up and send her to the hospital? And so I'm sitting there trying to push the wire off the filter, and it kinked on it. And suddenly the filter becomes, it's off the wall and it's starting to migrate up. And so, and my sheath is, you know, the filter's crooked. It's migrating. It's crooked. And so it's not like I can get my sheath over top because I don't have the other side of that wire. So this is like, okay, what to do here? And then, you know, thanks to the Cook rep, he grabs a much bigger sheath. We changed the original sheath over it was huge. I don't even know what it was. Like, but I just came down like, you know, and just engulfed the whole thing and just was able to just pull the whole thing out. And that's where really the sales rep saved my ass, because I wouldn't have it. I didn't have anything on the shelf, right, to do that. And so, you know, what, again, seems like a simple procedure that you should be able to, that you think you're going to knock out in 10 minutes could have been a total shit show.
It's nuts. Let me give you a little MacGyver corollary to that. So in the hospital, I've done started to do a lot of cava clear cases, right? So I'm doing, you know, complex filter retrievals with Philips laser sheath. So I'm using the cava clear. And I've done, I don't know, over a dozen of them. They've done really well, but none of my partners have done them. So my partner ends up getting a case for a filter that's been in for a long time. And he hasn't used the device. He doesn't even know about the device. But he uses loop snare with a glide wire, right? So he's used the glide wire, gets around it. And as he's pulling and pulling and pulling, you know, something happens where the wire gets stuck. He can't get the wire to go forward. He can't get the wire to go back. Catheter's gone. So same situation. He's got a wire hanging out the neck. It's kinked and stuck and wrapped around.
Yeah.
So he finds out that we have this cava clear laser sheath. He slides it inside the sheath that's in over the glide wire, and for like 20 minutes just turns the laser on and pushes it against the wire until it literally ate its way through the wire and the wire came free by using the laser sheath on the glide wire. It's like I was just cranking it up for 20 minutes just hoping that this thing would cut through, and it finally did. So that's off label, folks.
That's awesome.
But yeah, it's like trying to figure out what is it that we can do with what we have wherever we are to make this a salvageable situation. So as you're telling me that story, I'm giggling about, you know, this wire, you know, not coming out, and what you're going to do about it. Like, hey, so laser sheath it. Just no big deal.
Yeah. And I've never had a wire, like I've done loop snare, you know, multiple times, never had that issue before. And of course it's going to happen of all places where I don't need it to happen, right? Where I don't have what I need. So, you know, anything else, Omar, that you wanted to cover in this episode?
I carry, you know, the snares, right? 7 French and 6 French snares, like that could, or even 4 French snares, I guess, for like small arteries up to like big arteries, right? Or big vessels. I always carry a 6 millimeter.
For the tip of the atherectomy device, of whatever it is.
for uh-huh. anything you need.
Wires that are breaking off.
I always carry, I have like a 7 millimeter and a 6 millimeter Viabond. And I also have 6 millimeter and like up to 8 millimeter covered balloon expandable stents. I think I carry Life Streams, you know, and these are for like maybe iliacs or just some type of complication. Or to handle a complication if like, say your 7 Viabond's not big enough, right? If you can crank up that 6 or 7 balloon with a balloon expandable stent to, you know, 10 millimeters if you have to, or 12 or something, so.
I keep a 13.5 as well for central veins. Yeah. So God forbid.
Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. Yeah. If I'm doing any central vein work, I don't do it in this one particular OBL, but this other OBL where I work at a nephrology practice, we have those fluencies as well, right? Like those, the 14 millimeter fluence, like 13.5 millimeter fluencies. I carry Rotarex, which for atherectomy, but it can be useful sometimes for thrombectomy. I have this Pounce device, which I've never used, but I have it for thrombectomy. Okay.
I have one great Pounce case. I'm 1 for 1.
Oh, okay. Good.
I sent a big chronic thrombus, or like a piece of, you know, pencil eraser from a chronically occluded iliac artery stent down to the trifurcation. And so I reversed, stuck a 7 French, you know, destination sheath down to it, got a wire past it, pounced it. You know, the Pounce is almost like a stent retriever of some sort. You know, it's basically you kind of put this basket out and kind of pull it back in. Got this huge, you know, chunk, sits on Twitter somewhere. But I'm 1 for 1. I hope to not use it, but I keep it around, same as you. I mean, we're in lockstep here. What else you got?
All types of wires, right? You need wires to get all the way down to the toes, right? Sometimes, I mean, I probably have a Sci, like, you know, like Scion Black, you know, all types of Fielder XTs, those type of things can bail you out if you have some kind of distal occlusion or emboli or something that you really need to get really distal. That's saved me a bunch of times. A nice trick is if you have some type of emboli or something that's like so subtle, but you know, you lose like a one vessel runoff, you can get a catheter, maybe a 018 catheter all the way down to one of these plantar vessels, and then just put a 20 cc syringe on it and hook it up to suction and just kind of pull it out, and it'll clear it. It works like a lot. And that might save you from, you know, having to use some penumbra or something. So these are little tricks that I use in the OBL. I'm trying to think of anything else, but yeah. I mean, I have a lot of alliances, right? I mean, Watts works with vascular surgeons. I have a lot of vascular surgeons. I mean, I share clinic with vascular surgeons. I share, you know, one of the OBLs with a vascular surgeon. So, I mean, having a multidisciplinary practice is also a big benefit, right? Then where you don't, if you need something surgical, you can call a friend to help you out. What else? I think that covers a lot of it.
Yeah. I think, you know, it, as old school it is, we keep the AngioJet around and it's bailed us a couple of times, definitely bailed us out a couple of times. We'd be remiss by doing an oh shit, it's the OBL, if we didn't talk about a ruptured iliac artery, or just to do it.
Oh, yeah. Because
people are starting out and it's going to happen. Right. So this is what I do. You know, external iliacs, commons too, but external iliacs is where it's going to get you. And what you're going to do is you're going to cross an iliac and a complete occluded external iliac, and you're going to put a stent in. It's going to be, you know, might be a bare metal stent, either balloon expandable, self expandable, whatever it is, because you're in the OBL and iliac stents, you know, a self expanding stent in the external iliac is patency is great. It takes the curves and it's good. And you're going to inject, and you're like, all right, I like where the stent is. And then you're going to go inflate it, and it may be a 7 or 8 millimeter stent. You're going to inflate it to 5 or 6. And you're like, all right, let's see what this looks like. And then you're going to see, boom, explosion, right? So you need to be prepared before you do that. So this happens to me all the time. Everybody in the room knows it, new tech, new nurse, it doesn't matter. So once I say, oh, there's an external iliac artery occlusion, they all know what that means, right? So right now, you know, I'm crossing with an 035 wire. And then once I have the stent deployed, I change out to an 018 command. And I change out to an 018 command because my 6 French Viabon is an 018. And so I have my 6 French Viabon in the room. So it's an 8x10 or 8x5 or whatever it is. And I am ready. So we balloon. I balloon, you know, low pressure, smaller balloon. And then I send that balloon up into the aorta and I inject through the sheath immediately. And before I do, I tell my nurse, we're cycling the pressures. You know, make sure you have fluid ready. My techs are there. I send that balloon up into the aorta and I inject through the sheath very, very quickly. And if I see anything, balloon comes right back down, balloon goes up, done. We could stand there. We can wait, check that pressure. She's like, well, the pressure was running 130. Now it's 80 over 50. All right. Give fluids, stay here for 5 minutes, check that pressure again. Pressure's 90, 92. Okay, great. So you know what to do. You know what to do. Open up the Viabon. This wire is way up. We're not going to lose it. Viabon's ready. Balloon's still up. Okay, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to deflate this balloon. You're going to hold the sheath. I'm going to pull the balloon back. I'm going to basically, you know, put it, I want you to, you know, grab it here. I'm going to slide the Viabon on. We're going to rip it back, balloon, done. This is going to take 45 seconds at most. And we're going to be, you know, we're going to make sure that we know exactly where we're covering and we're covering the right thing. And then once that's all done, balloon goes back up, hold another, like, you know, minute or two. What's the pressure? Drop back down to 81. She's looking a little pale. All right, still giving fluids. 5 minutes later, where are we? Pressure's 135. I'm like, okay. Take the balloon down, check, and we're good. This is going to happen. And if you're not ready for it, if you don't understand that the balloon up equals safe, and you can make all the plans in the world while the balloon is up, but you have to know your sheath size. If it's a fluency, it's a 7. If it's a Viabon, it could be a 6. If it's 018, if it's 035, you're not going to get it over the 018 wire. These are just things that you need to have in your head, because that's life and death. Right. I mean, that's life and death. The rest of these things, you know, they can become a catastrophe, but that's life and death. So, you know, you can't do this talk without at least mentioning that.
You're right, Watts. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks for summarizing that.
And what I do is I just put in the Viabon first. Just, I don't even want that problem.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think it may be 10% of external iliac artery occlusions may do this. And I don't know that people talk about that number, because they talk about iliac occlusions in general. I've never seen it in the common. I see it in more externals than I probably should. And I'm not aggressive. I'm not like leaving, you know, I'm not going, you know, subintimal and doing some massive inflation. They're just prone to it. They're just really, really prone to it. And, you just can't be surprised if I inject and I'm surprised by an iliac rupture, I need to reexamine how I'm treating patients, because I need to know that that's coming, and I need everybody else in the room to know it's coming. And when I inject it, it's fine. Say, all right, good. We're good. Let's breathe. And then it's back to listening to Sugar Ray on the radio and, you know, kind of just talking about our weekends and whatever it is we do, you know, because that's how we roll.
Yeah. 90s music all the time.
Always.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. Anything else, Omar? I mean, I think that was a good way to put a pin in it, is like that sort of algorithm, I think, will be super helpful for anybody who hasn't experienced that out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a pretty good talk. I mean, there's so many things, you know, we could talk about. I mean, go for like hours and hours about, you know, things that could happen and how to fix it. But yeah, this is a pretty good couple of examples of like, and maybe give some people out there ideas of what to have in their, on their shelves, and like how to, you know, handle some of these situations if they don't have this type of experience and they're starting out.
Watts, Omar, thank you again for coming back on. Looking forward to the next time. Looking forward to hanging out. Maybe anybody going to SIR? I'll be there.
I'll be there.
Are you guys going? I really want to go, but I'll have to. I'm going to be in like Kansas to visit family for something. I don't know. Yeah, so
you've never been because you're always in Disney. You're always at Disneyland.
I'm always at Disneyland.
you're Mammoth. You're somewhere that's not where SIR is every year.
I know.
Always.
We'll play next year.
But there's Western Agio in Hawaii, Omar.
May have to sign up for that. Hopefully, I can get in on that one. Are you guys going to go? You think or?
I'm faculty, I'm going theoretically. I need to get the family involved because they never go with me anywhere. But yeah, this is one they need to go to, and so I need to.
That'd be a good one. Yeah. Maybe we'll try to do that.
I'll be there too.
We can do another one there in Hawaii.
I'll talk about Leah Fainstead.
Sounds good.
Sweet. There you go.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Lanbir Singh Sundu.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.